I would invite you to imagine that this is Monday, the 9th of August, that you're at the Freiburg New Church Assembly. I am George Dole. My title this morning is The Samaritans Revisited. And this lecture turned out to be what it didn't start out to be, in that it's mostly background. I didn't get where I expected to because there was too much background that needed to be dealt with. In the Gospels, we find the Promised Land divided into three sections, with Judea in the south, Galilee in the north, and Samaria between them. This is roughly the same territory that was divided between Judah and Israel in the Old Testament, and the change is worth looking at with some care. Some of the necessary background for this was included in my lectures last week, and since not all present today were here then, some review is appropriate. I'll make it as brief as I can. In a larger overview of the ancient Near East, Palestine stands at the intersection of Europe, Asia, and Africa. In biblical times, it tended to be little more than a passageway between the classic great empires of Mesopotamia and Egypt, and the establishment of what we think of as the Davidic Empire was an anomaly, possible only because Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt were all in decline at the same time. The major route between Mesopotamia and Egypt passed through the northern part of the Holy Land, crossing the Rift Valley at the Sea of Galilee, traversing the plain of Esdraelon to Megiddo, and then following the Mediterranean coast to Egypt. In so doing, it completely bypassed the mountainous region between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, the territory that came to be known as Judah. And one significant effect of this was a major difference between Judah and the northern half of the Holy Land, Israel. Judah, that is, was off the beaten track. It tended to be provincial and conservative. Israel was where the international action was and tended to be cosmopolitan and progressive. What we classify as the historical books of the Old Testament are the story as seen through the eyes of Judah. In this view, there is only one true temple, and the survival of the nation depends on exclusive fidelity to it. Of course, sacrifices to other gods are anathema, but sacrifices to the Lord at any other location constitute a major transgression. This is the principle articulated in Deuteronomy 12, and it's presented with remarkable force. Deuteronomy retells the story of the giving of the Ten Commandments. This is followed by an extended set of injunctions to obedience that comes to a climax with promises of blessings for obedience and curse for disobedience. So if we start with the closing verse of these injunctions at the close of the 11th chapter and continue into the beginning of the 12th, it sounds like this, and I quote, "You are about to cross the Jordan and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you. When you have taken it over and are living there, be sure that you obey all the decrees and laws I am setting before you today. These are the decrees and laws that you must be careful to follow in the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess, as long as you live in the land. Destroy completely all the places on the high mountains and on the hills and under every spreading tree where the nations you are dispossessing worship their gods. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, burn their Asherah poles in the fire, cut down the idols of their gods, and wipe out their names from those places." So far, so good. Obviously, the Israelites are not to worship other gods. But the commandment does not stop there. It continues, "You must not worship the Lord your God in their way. Rather, you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling. To that place you must go. There bring your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and special gifts, what you have vowed to give, and your freewill offerings, the firstborn of your herds and flocks. There, in the presence of the Lord your God, you and your families shall eat and shall rejoice in everything you have put your hand to, because the Lord your God has blessed you. You are not to do as we do here today, everyone as he sees fit, since you have not yet reached the resting place and the inheritance the Lord your God is giving you. But you will cross the Jordan. You will settle in the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies around you, so that you will live in safety. Then, to the place the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name, there you are to bring everything I command you, your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes and special gifts, and all the choice possessions you have vowed to the Lord. And there, rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maidservants, and the Levites from your towns who have no allotment or inheritance of their own. Be careful not to sacrifice your burnt offerings anywhere you please. Offer them only at the place the Lord will choose in one of your tribes, and there observe everything I command you. Close quote. And only after this has been made so abundantly clear and has been reinforced with further promises of blessing for obedience and curse for disobedience, do we return to the subject of the worship of other gods and handle that at comparable length. It almost seems as that worshiping the right God in the wrong way, at the wrong place, is a more serious transgression than worshiping the wrong God. And this isn't as unlikely as it might sound. For the true religious conservative, the true believer, the believer who leaves the fold poses less of a threat than the one who professes to believe but who tries to turn the faith from its true path, the enemy within one's own household. The Christian who believes that all who do not accept Jesus Christ are damned has usually less to say about Buddhists than about people who claim to be Christians but don't believe that this kind of acceptance is necessary. To the Muslim who sees Islam only in terms of a rigid theocratic state, the most dangerous threat comes not from non-Muslims or from ex-Muslims, but from secular Muslims. The arch enemy of Osama bin Laden is not George Bush, it's Saddam Hussein, the secularist. And in the Gospels, we find some Jews associating with Gentile Romans. But the woman at the well in the Gospel of John reminds us that the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. You must not worship the Lord your God in their way. Samaritan, thanks to the parable of the Good Samaritan, has become a very nice word. To us, it means someone who comes to the rescue of people in need and who does so simply out of caring with no thought of reward. But that is not what it meant in the Gospel. And perhaps the most direct way to make this point is to say that by any modern definition of the word Jew, the Samaritans were Jews. They were, that is, descendants of Abraham. The woman at the well says, refers to our father Jacob, who dug this well. Descendants of Abraham, whose scriptures were the five books of Moses, they worshiped the God of Israel according to their understanding of those books. While we have little inside information about their practices, we can be quite sure that they practiced circumcision, obeyed the dietary laws, observed the Passover and the like with as reasonable fidelity as anyone. There's a well-attested text of the Samaritan Pentateuch that differs only very slightly from the received text. There is no comparable text of the historical books, which in any case are clearly a product of the southern kingdom of Judah. But the woman at the well expresses belief in some prophecy of a coming Messiah, so they apparently were aware of the prophetic tradition as well. But the Samaritans differed radically from the people the Gospels refer to as Jews in one primary respect. They did not accept the identification of Jerusalem as the place chosen by the Lord for his temple. When the Samaritan woman at the well realized that Jesus was, in her words, a prophet, this was the first and really the only issue that she raised. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem. Well, in fact, the Greek word translated as Jews in the Gospel is Judaioi, and it might better be translated as Judeans. That's where it comes from. We would do better to drop the word Jews entirely when trying to understand the situation that obtained in Gospel times and refer instead to the larger collective as Israelites, divided into Judeans who believed that the temple should be in Judea and Samaritans who believed that it should be in Samaria. And the Samaritan woman, incidentally, is the only individual in the New Testament who refers to Jesus as a Jew, meaning a Judean, because he presumably believes that that the temple in Jerusalem is the place where they should worship. Well, to understand this, we need to turn back to the 17th chapter of the second book of Kings. This is where we learn of the conquest of Israel, the northern kingdom, by the Assyrian king Shalmaneser, and the deportation of what came to be known as the 10 lost tribes. The chapter goes on to say that all this took place because Israel had lapsed into idolatry. But then it includes the interesting note that even Judah did not keep the commands of the Lord their God. They followed the practices that Israel had introduced. Well, the deportation would have been far from complete. The people who were taken away and resettled would have been those who had some wealth and influence, and not the illiterate farmers and shepherds and the like, who had no political voice and posed no threat, but who, incidentally, were basic to the economic survival of the land. We can be quite... When Judah fell to Babylon, there was a similar deportation. I quote from 2 Kings 25, "The commander left behind some of the poorest people of the land to work the vineyards and the fields." Well, we can be quite sure not only that the Assyrians followed the same practice, but also that the poorest of the land, the working public, included a majority of the total population. The account of Assyria's conquest of Israel continues with a note that because the Lord sent lions into the land, the king of Assyria sent an Israelite priest back, and I quote, "to teach the people what the God of the land requires." So one of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria came to live in Bethel and taught them how to worship the Lord, close quote. And it then goes on to say that the people who were imported from other lands, other conquered lands, brought their own religious practices with them, and that a form of mixed worship developed that lasted to this day, whatever that day was. And with that note, the account of events in the north comes to a close. The rest of 2 Kings tells the story of the decline and fall of Judah and ends with Judah in captivity. We get a glimpse of Judah in captivity in the book of Ezekiel, but other than that, there's little but silence until the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which tell of the return from captivity and the rebuilding of the temple. Nehemiah tells of active opposition by a coalition that included Samaritans, Ammonites, and Arabs, but gives little background for this. And there is another account that says the Samaritans came and offered to help, but were turned down. What we must supply is the realization that for two generations, Jerusalem had lain in ruins, while Samaria had presumably carried on as usual and may well have prospered. Theirs was the only worship of the Lord in the Holy Land, the Promised Land. They had every reason to believe that God had decisively rejected Judah's claim that Jerusalem was the place chosen to set God's name. After all, the temple lay in ruins. It had been judged because of the sins of Judah. It lay in ruins. There was probably no one alive who could remember what it looked like. It had been judged. It had been found wanting. It was not there anymore. And then we should also bear in mind that the Jerusalem temple had actually been the sole center of sacrificial worship only briefly, only during part of Solomon's reign. He began its construction in the fourth year of his reign. It took him 7 years to build it. He's credited with a reign of 40 years. Israel's secession seems to have happened right after his death, And Jeroboam, the king of the northern seceders, promptly had temples built in Bethel and in Dan. So the temple stood unchallenged for 29 years plus building time out of all the centuries of Israelite history. Well, in fact, at the beginning of 1 Samuel, we find Samuel's parents to be bringing their sacrifices to the house of the Lord, and that's a temple, in the northern town of Shiloh. We're never told that such a house has been built, but there's a mention of its doorpost in the account in Samuel, and there's a very convincing reference to it in the 7th chapter of Jeremiah. In a fervid denunciation of blind trust in the Jerusalem temple, the prophet offers the following words of the Lord, I quote, "Go now to the place in Shiloh where I first made a dwelling for my name, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel." Well, the place where I first made a dwelling for my name is an unmistakable allusion to Deuteronomy 12:5, which I read earlier. Rather, you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling. And the phrase is echoed in the promise to David concerning Solomon. He is the one who will build a house for my name. And in the account of the building of the temple, there are no fewer than 12 references to it as the place for the Lord's name. And that's in 1 Kings 5-8, roughly, mostly 5 and 8. And there's another cluster of such references in 1 Kings 16. So from a northern point of view, Jerusalem's claim to be the only possible location of the temple was simply indefensible. The first place God had chosen had been Shiloh, and its destruction was evidence that God had later rejected it. Judah could well argue that God had then chosen Jerusalem, but this would mean that the subsequent destruction of Jerusalem was evidence of its rejection. And this is exactly what Jeremiah is trying to get across. Don't trust in this temple. God can reject it. God can destroy it. Look what he already did. Well, when the exiles returned then and started to rebuild the Jerusalem temple, the northerners had every right to see this as going against God's will. Some might say, fine, the more temples the better. Others, the more conservatives, would say, no, God has not rejected our temple. That was how Judah had seen Jeroboam's building of temples in Bethel and Dan. You don't build a new temple until God has destroyed the old one. And throughout the story of the divided kingdom, even the best of the northern kings is charged with not departing from the sin of Jeroboam that he had caused Israel to commit. This includes Jehu, who was as ferociously, exclusively, bloodthirstily loyal to the Lord God of Israel as any king before or after. Now, the sin of Jeroboam was the building of rival temples. Now, this may not be easy for us to swallow because we are the heirs of the tradition that sees Jerusalem as the chosen city. The crucial events of Holy Week took place in Jerusalem. The Bible concludes with John's vision of the descent of the holy city, New Jerusalem. We tend to pay little attention to the fact that most of the Lord's ministry took place in Galilee, which is Galilee of the Gentiles, even farther removed from Jerusalem than Samaria. And in fact, when Philip first told Nathanael that the one prophesied by Moses was Jesus of Nazareth, Nathanael's first reaction was one of incredulity. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And incidentally, Jesus' first words to Nathanael were, here is a true, not Jew, here is a true Israelite, one in whom there is no guile. Well, where does all this leave us when it comes to our efforts to see spiritual meaning? I would suggest that in the first place, it demands that we read the literal sense of the Gospels with a much greater awareness of the extent to which first century Judaism comprised distinct sects that were often significantly at odds with each other. It has finally come through to me that of the three accounts that involve the identification of the two great commandments, love to the Lord and love to the neighbor, two of them have Jesus making this identification, One has the identification made by the individual who's talking with him. This individual was a teacher of the law, and Jesus says, what do you think? And he says, these are the two, love to the Lord and love to the neighbor. These are the greatest. And it is his subsequent question, and who is my neighbor, that led to the parable of the Good Samaritan. So some Israelites, some Judeans, some even teachers of the law, who usually get very bad press in the Gospels, were evidently thinking along the lines of the two great commandments before Jesus came on the scene. So this was a religion and a land divided in a number of ways. Those divisions should be taken seriously. Well, the tripartite division of the land reflected in the Gospels has traditionally been interpreted as representing the usual Swedenborgian trine, with Judah corresponding to the heart, Samaria to the mind, and Galilee to outward life. And what little we find in the writings supports this. Judea is equated with the celestial church in Secrets of Heaven 24:54. The celestial or heavenly level of reality is the realm of love or of the heart. Samaria gets more attention, being equated with the spiritual church, so I quote, in three passages, and with the church in the affection of truth in another. This, again, this is the mind. There are only five references to Galilee in the published theological works, none of which comments on its meaning, but in Revelation Explained, it's interpreted as meaning, and I quote, the establishment of the church among Gentiles who are in the good of life and who accept truth. So this, again, supports the notion that Galilee refers primarily to our outward behavioral life. And this, for me, makes it particularly intriguing that so little attention is given to Samaria in the accounts of Jesus' life and ministry. Samaria is little more than the region Jesus must pass through in his travels between Galilee and Judea. And as I reflect on this, it seems to be saying that at this point in the journey of regeneration, and when I consider where it's placed in the biblical story, it has to be a well-advanced place in that journey, the main focus is not intellectual. The ministry in Galilee would have to do with discerning and responding to the presence of the sacred in the ordinary events of everyday living. That focus is on what we do and say, on how we behave toward each other. And the other main area is that of the heart. It is here that the most virulent opposition to Jesus is to be found. Here that he is tried, condemned, and crucified. Here is where the final decisions are made. And this is not a matter of mistaken thinking so much as of feelings of supreme self-importance. And the area of thought lies between this area of feeling and the area of behavior. And it may be that if we do our best to live heavenly lives and to reject any claims to self-importance, our essential thought processes will pretty much take care of themselves. We will learn from our experiences because we'll be open to learning, non-defensive. We won't reject or distort truths because they seem to impugn our self-image or because they ask us to behave more generously toward each other than we might want to. We'll be sensitive to the seductive nature of what we might call affirmative falsities that pamper our egos and negative falsities that undermine our hope. We'll find that blessed state of unself-consciousness that is simply trying to discern what is going on in and around us. And our Samaria will simply be silently there, linking our love with our life. And this may tie in with a thought arising from my work on the New Century Edition. I had begun some time ago to suspect that the familiar phrase, the good of love, means not so much the goodness of love or the good feeling of love, but the good that love does when we actually intend it and, to the extent that we can, put it into practice. And one reference recently in Revelation Unveiled jumped out at me in this connection. To use the traditional translation, By fruits are signified the goods of love and charity, which are called good works." Close quote. And further search turned up a number of other passages of similar import. For example, "When we are no longer in the grips of the evil of murder, but are caught up in love toward the neighbor, then whatever we do is a good of that love, and is therefore a good work." Or again, "Uses are goods of love and charity." And perhaps most informatively, this is from Doctrine of Life, this shows that truths are the means through which the good of love becomes manifest and becomes something. Samaria is the means through which the love becomes manifest and becomes something, namely action, behavior. There are other passages where the good of love is described as something that flows into us, so I wouldn't argue that good works are the only goods of love, but I now do feel that whenever we run across that phrase, we need to ask whether this is what it means in this particular context. I think it must always mean something good that love does, something love does for us that is good. Revelation Unveiled, for example, takes the statement that the holy city was pure gold like clear glass to mean that every element of that church, that is the new church, is the good of love flowing in, united to light out of heaven from the Lord. And a similar statement is made concerning the streets of city being pure gold like clear glass. Everything true in that church and its doctrine is in form the good of love flowing in, united to light out of heaven from the Lord. And this, I more and more think, is telling us that the essence of the new church is the impulse to do wise and loving things. So to reconnect with today's topic, it sounds as though there is a kind of infinite affinity between Judea and Galilee. It makes me wonder why in the Old Testament we deal only with Judah and Israel with the, quote, will and understanding and not with some equivalent of Galilee as well. But above all, it suggests that we might look more sympathetically at that remnant of the northern kingdom that became the Samaritans. They're given little attention in the gospel stories, it is true, but they do constitute the link between Judea and Galilee, between my heart and my life. The floor would be yours if there were any real floor here.